Hi, welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Andrew Kadnack. Joining me is John Purcell and Annabelle Crapp. Annabelle, thanks for joining us.
I was promised tarts.
I'm aware of that. And you might notice that there's just a tinge of maybe animosity in Annabelle's voice. I will give some context to the situation. Last time Annabelle came in for her wonderful book, The Wife Drought.
Or The Man Drought.
The Man Drought. I may have tweeted in excitement that you can get Annabelle's new book, The Man Drought, on Twitter, which a lot of people enjoyed. Annabelle did. So I'm starting at about a -5 at the moment. So
plus there's no tarts.
There's no tarts. We're tartless. But we are talking about a book that, dare I say it, is not tartless. Special delivery.
I see what you did there. The original plan was you were going to bake tarts for me and I was going to cast judgment on them and I get here and there's no tarts. But that's all right.
I was terrified.
I mean, he was doing work for charity last night.
Yeah, I see what you're doing there too, you know. I don't care about those poor children. I want my tarts.
So tell us about special delivery, because it is, you know, you see a lot of these celebs like you coming in and putting these cookbooks
nice
together.
Yeah.
But it is genuinely a beautiful book. It reminds me of your classic CWA, the cooking books, everything. I looked there, and I can be a little bit picky with desserts.
I had your ginger fluff, didn't I?
The ginger fluff, yeah.
The ginger fluff. You've got a ginger fluff in your past, haven't you?
I do. Ethel's ginger fluffs. Ooh. Always one at the Hay Show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
You see, the ginger fluff is like an ancient craft that is handed down from lady to lady in the CWA. And it's one of those, it's a cake that's, it's a very light sponge. And it's one of those things where people think, oh yeah, how hard can that be? The truth is, it's a very, very sly and canny beast, the ginger fluff. You've got to have the right wrist action. And
it's all giggles until the whisking begins.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I buggered up my first ginger fluff. Wendy, my co-author, is just a genius of the fluff because she got it directly from her granny.
Ah, right.
It passes down that way.
Mm.
You can just keep saying ginger fluff. That's good enough for me.
Just gets. And if you say, what was your Edith?
Ethel's
ginger fluff.
Ginger fluff is just. Particularly with a straight face, as I said to you off mic, that when Mum says, you have to try Ethel's ginger fluff. And I've come home from a boys' school and I go, I can't do this. You don't need much to set me off. That's ridiculous.
But look, I love the CWA tradition, I've got to say. Because look, the CWA in many ways is a really subversive social organisation. It was about women in particular areas kind of taking some control of their lives, getting together, sharing information. You know, it was like a social support structure as well as a baking circle. And I'm a big fan of those things that food can do, you know, get people together, get them to abandon their temporary rivalries and hostilities, although obviously at country shows that's all off. But they were early pioneers of the take and bake model, you know, where you drop around to someone's house with some food just to show them that you're kind of thinking about them or that you mean them no harm. And I think it's a nice rule to live by.
In this modern world where everyone's staring at their smartphones, do you ever get strange looks when you arrive at homes with food, carrying food? I mean, it is a tradition that is sort of wobbly at the moment.
No, I didn't know about that at all.
I reckon that the
culture of recipe sharing and talking about food has just been massively assisted by the digital revolution. I mean, like, I love the way the internet helps me be a better cook. I spend quite a bit of time each day thinking about what I'm going to cook for dinner that night, and I'll do a bit of random Googling about an ingredient that I've got that I know I want to incorporate. And then you kind of look at things that various food bloggers have contributed and you kind of start stress testing in your mind a recipe to use. And I really like cooking like that. It's like having a million different friends to talk to. I mean, like, this book is very much about my relationship with my best friend from childhood, Wendy Sharp. We email each other relentlessly about food. She's the recipe consultant on Kitchen Cabinet. She is an incredibly inventive brain in the kitchen. She's a scientist by training, so she's much more precise than I am. But that kind of talking about food and sharing ideas is just something I really enjoy, and I kind of love doing that with total strangers on the interwebs. One of the nicest things since doing Kitchen Cabinet that happens to me every now and again is if I go you know, to speak somewhere or do a book signing or something. Sometimes, you know, it happens with charming regularity. Someone will turn up actually with biscuits, or some lady, I went to a talk with George Megalogenis for his excellent new book, Australia's Second Chance.
You know, I hear he's Australia's best explainer.
Yeah,
someone wrote that on the cover.
I said that years ago, and he keeps putting it on the cover of the books. Well, I haven't stopped meaning it, so it's very fortunate. But this lady turned up, this is in Canberra, with a whole box of these fabulous cupcakes that she'd made. She'd invented them herself. They're rosemary and rhubarb. Who never thought of that combination before? But they're really good. But it was so nice. I don't know. It was just, it was pretty cool. And the more people like that I can get in touch with, the better, I think.
More tarts arriving in your lap.
Yes, because I think, as we've discussed, I really like tarts, and I get sad when they're not there, obviously.
Yeah. We've done it again, Andrew.
Yeah, well, I can tell you another story that just reminded me when you're talking about this. This is the world, because I come from a similar world where I can't cook. And Mum doesn't have podcasts, you can't hear this. She's not a great cook, although she tries. But we're in a community, obviously, in the country where everyone's a really great cook.
Yeah.
But I was brought up to always bring something over.
Yeah.
So when I left school, I stayed for about a week while I was looking for a house for uni with friends, and Mum said, make sure you bring something. So I went to the supermarket and brought a pavlova shell and thought it was a pavlova from the shelves and brought it over. And she said...
A little on the dry side.
Yeah, and she said, oh, no, it's fine, you don't have to. And I went, no, there you go. And she went, oh, look. And I went, you can have it for dessert. And she went, we won't have it for dessert. And I went, no. And she said, it's just a shell, Andrew. It's not a pavlova. I don't know what you've done. But I knew.
Gosh.
See, and this is why special delivery is so good, because I knew that's what you needed to do.
You just didn't know how to do it.
God. The mechanism of actually getting whatever the food was. Yeah.
Well, the transport is the real challenge, too. And like... one of the things that I really love about Wendy, my co-author, is that she has just the most intrepid approach and a really emotional approach to transporting food. Like, she's the only person I know who actually gets tears of pride, a sort of tenderness, if she sees someone on the tube or on the bus balancing a cake with, you know, crazy toothpicks and cling film and like the ridiculous infrastructure that you build around a delicate dessert that you're trying to take from A to B. It's, you know, the challenge is great. And kitchen cabinet is great for transport challenges. When Wendy and I are working out what we're going to make for a particular politician, we always, like, we start off with, you know, where do they come from? What's their personal history? Are there sort of allusions to their history that we can make in this dessert? We spent so much time trying to work out what to take to Ricky Muir's place for this season. And we really wanted to take donuts, like, you know, petrol head gets donuts, get it? But we were filming in this sort of quite isolated log cabin with no power. So even an intrepid pair drew the line at, you know, making fresh donuts in a place without electricity, like hauling a deep fat fryer all the way. Like, it was just so dumb. But we really stuck with it until it became apparent that it was just not possible. So instead, we made this chocolate cake with a... topping of whipped cream and then a deconstructed rocky road, like sort of with marshmallows and chopped up dark chocolate and nuts and stuff, and we called it the Ricky Road Cake.
That's excellent.
It was pretty good.
That's great. And I think that's one of the interesting things. Oh, sorry, John.
Yeah, you just interrupted.
One of the interesting things about cooking, though, is that once you get the skills for cooking, and I'm not at that level, and it intrigues me, is that it's like playing guitar. Like, people want to play songs, but what you want to do is learn chords.
Yeah, right.
And so cooking to me... And this is where, like, experimenting with cooking, that's what you want to get to as a home cook, because then you can start like that. Just what you do with Wendy is working out someone's from here, rather than...
Some new complicated riffs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's exciting, yeah. I think, when you hear that sort of stuff.
Well, I think always starting with simple stuff is just, like, the most obvious piece of advice, but...
like a crust of... Pavlova.
Yeah, like a crust of pavlova. But see, you were nearly
That's
there,
it. Just
really.
Put it out there.
All you needed was just to like whip up some cream and then, you know, and that's not tricky.
No.
I wouldn't suggest you move on to ginger fluff straight away,
no,
to be honest. But but look, there's heaps of stuff in the book that we wrote that is quite simple. The other thing that the point we tried to make in this book, and it's the only cookbook I'm aware of that has, apart from having a an ingredients index, it has an occasion index. This is the greatest thing. It's Wendy's idea, and it's just genius. So there's an index of the sorts of occasions on which you might take food to someone's house, and the best recipes to take for them, you know, in those cases. So, like, you know, obviously... bring a plate to a barbie sort of stuff, there's salads and there's cakes and whatever. But then what do you take to someone who's been bereaved, or someone who's just had a baby, or someone who's like, we've even got a listing for the overwhelmed. And the overwhelmed are a really important group for as recipients of home-baked meals. Like, you know, when you're worried about somebody, you know, they're really strung out and you're worried they're not taking care of themselves, and you want to let them know that you're thinking about them and you're worried about them and you want to help them in some way. But that person is not the right person to take your buffalo mozzarella salad that has to be eaten when it's absolutely fresh, fresh, fresh. Just assemble and eat. It's gorgeous. Because your overwhelmed person or your depressed person is going to put that in their fridge and not get to it. Like, you know, they won't do it straight away, and then it'll be a bit past its prime, and then it'll be actually off, and then they'll be even more depressed when they have to throw it in the bin because they couldn't get it together to actually, you know, eat the gift that you so kindly brought them. I mean, that person is then more depressed. So you've got to take something a bit more hearty for those people. Yeah,
imagine staring at that depressed, wilted salad.
I know, exactly. So to that person, you take a jar of muesli or something, or, you know, some nuts or some biscuits that can just sit there in the tin just for when they have a moment.
You got a nice birch and muesli recipe.
A lovely birch and muesli recipe.
Yeah.
I wasn't a big fan of the birch and muesli initially, but Wendy really kept at me about it. She kept bringing it round, and in the end I was forced to admit that it really is very, very, for an intentionally soggy food, which I'm not normally, you know, it's not normally on my radar, it is pretty good. You need lots of fruit in it, I reckon.
Though. Yeah, that's true.
You mentioned Kitchen Confidential before.
What is it with new people?
Don't you hate it when people get the wrong names of things? I feel it's infuriating.
I'm gone. Just close the door on the way.
We're mentioning Cabinet Confidential.
Oh, my name's not Annabelle Crud.
I had two in my mind and I just went the wrong one. I'm always 50-50. I always choose the wrong one.
It's great to be here at Book World. Look, you guys at Amazon are doing such great stuff.
Yeah.
Alice Crabb, she's got, yeah. Anyway. So
this is going very well.
Do you want me to start?
If there had been tarts, I promise this would have been going better. Yeah.
So should I lead in?
You can do what you like.
We're talking about Kitchen Cabinet. Come
on. Well, I want to know whether there are certain foods which open people up to conversation. Like, is there a way to make sure that you can, if you're going to your depressed friend and you're actually staying, you're not just dumping and running.
Mm.
What would you do? What would be the way to enliven conversation?
I would take them something that obliges them to do something with their hands. That is the best way to get somebody talking. If you just take the attention away from them thinking about what they're saying and get them doing something, it totally changes the dynamics of a conversation. And it is something that we always use in Kitchen Cabinet, because we're like, we turn up to someone's house with four cameras. It's really hard to be unobtrusive when there are four cameras at first, which is why I noticed at the beginning of the show it's always super awkward. And we always edit it like in the beginning.
Clive.
It was
Hi,
just
Annabelle.
So, you know, and then you sort of go in for the kiss and you bump noses and you're like, well, is it appropriate to give you a kiss anyway? Like, I mean, you're a senator and I hardly know you. But I think the awkwardness is important. Like, it's realistically, that's what happens when you go around to someone's house, particularly if you don't know them that well. It's like, oh, I brought you flowers. Where do I put them? Whoa, I'm standing here. then it steadily gets less awkward over the process. And the food preparation is a really important bit, because it's when they start to relax, and it's probably because they're doing stuff with their hands, they're, you know, shelling peas or they're chopping things, and it actually, I don't know whether it obliges you to use a slightly different part of your brain, but it means that you can kind of ask them different sorts of questions, I think, and they can answer in a different way, because the fact that they're preparing food makes it incredibly clear to everybody that this is not a sort of a, you know, routine political media interview.
But you're right, they're using something, because I remember watching it, and I think I remember the first time I realised that was happening was when you were talking to Tanya Plibersek, and you were talking about her husband being in prison, and you were both sort of making a salad, and I remember thinking, oh, I know what's going on here, and it's brilliant. Like, it's amazing.
That's the thing with the show is there was a bit of flack last week with the Morrison.
Oh, yeah. Yes, there was a bit of flack from from A Quarter, I think,
On Twitter?
Yeah.
Heavens above. No, what?
I felt they just, I mean, it was obvious, but they just completely missed the point of your show. You allow the politician, you don't need to be the one tripping them up or doing anything or going the hard question, because you bring them out. And sometimes that's the best thing for anyone out here who has to vote for them, is to actually see who they are.
Look, I understand that the concerns, because people, like, there is an issue about journalism and politics, and like, what is the relationship between journalists and politics? And so some people, particularly, I think, you know, people with the Morrison episode who really have a really serious problem with Morrison and his policies, which is perfectly fine. It's not the case for everybody, but it's the case very strongly for some people, can't bear the thought of anyone being nice to somebody that they disagree with so deeply. But, then they start questioning, well, look, what is the role of journalism, and what's the relationship between a journalist and a politician? Look, my perspective on that is that I'm really careful to be the same way with everybody, and I feel that that respects the different views that viewers have. I think that knowing that the same treatment will be given to everybody, no matter what their individual kind of policy positions and decisions are, is an important part of the reliability of the program. It's not like a news interview. We're getting different sort of insights, I think, and I think that they are, you know, not more important than the sort of insights you get from sort of standard heavy questioning, but they are different. They're the sort of things that you notice about people when you go around to their house. And of course, when you go around to their house, you're not going to kick the door in and start, you know, barking at them. And I think the day that I start being nice to people with whom I agree, and less nice to people with whom I have, you know, difficulties on domestic policy issues, is the day that the show becomes about me rather than about them and about the viewer, which I think is wrong.
Well, I think you do it serves at the moment, because a lot of the interviews that we see, they're prepared for, and they put up their barriers and they have a script and they follow those scripts. And yours, even if they try with all their might to present a certain picture of themselves, the circumstances are so foreign but so comfortable.
Yeah, well, that it's hard to behave differently in your own home, you know. I mean, of course they're on their best behaviour and whatever. But seeing somebody in that environment is a different thing from seeing them function, you know, in a media studio or something like that. So it's funny. You just get funny little glimpses of people, or you see the way they respond to, you know, a more normal social situation, and you kind of, you get funny little pointers or things that you remember about somebody. And also you find out, I mean, the show is mainly about talking to people about their lives and their way into politics. And I think that that is quite important stuff, because, look, the decisions that politicians make every day about what they're going to get interested in and what they're going to flick past, you know, the issues that they will choose to fight to the death on, and the ones that they'll just not buy into, put in the too hard basket, those decisions happen, you know, on a daily basis. And the spectrum of issues that politicians can get interested in is so broad that the stuff that what drives those decisions is so subjective and so based on their worldview, on their experiences in life, what's happened to them and their family, that if you know a little bit about that, then you start to understand why they make the decisions they do, and you can predict a bit more how they're going to behave. Like Scott Morrison, for instance, his childhood in a kind of like strict religious family, you know, I mean, we had a look at the picture of him in his year six class, and he's the only kid wearing a tie. Like, this is a guy who is used to kind of, I said to him during the interview, like, your childhood has rendered you embarrassment proof. And I think that there is something to that, because, you know, he is one of the most, probably the most divisive figure in federal politics, with a certain kind of part of the community. And I just, one thing that really I struck me when I spent that day with him is that I just really think that he does not care about that. And that is a, that's a really weird human place to get to genuinely not care. Like, I mean, he says, does I sleep well at night? I think he really does.
Yeah.
And that, you know, if I was in politics, I wouldn't be like that. I find that so interesting. Yeah. How do people get that way? Well, I don't know. Maybe their mothers forced them onto the stage too early and they were like, they're in an embarrassing family or whatever. Like, his dad was the chief of police at Waverley at the same time as being the Lord, you know, the mayor of Waverley. Like, anyway, people's lives are fascinating. And they explain a lot about the adults, you know, they produce. And I think that it's useful to know that stuff about politicians.
Yeah, and the other thing about Kitchen Cabinet is really fascinating is I look for, I feel like it's Supermarket Sweep, where, what are we having today? And Clive Palmer will say, well, I just whipped up a gazpacho. And you go, you didn't make that at all. There's no chance. Or, you know, Joe Hockey will be barbecuing a steak. I mean, it shows how food is such an interesting portal into someone's personality as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, even the question of competence and incompetence and how people are, if they can't cook, whether they are freaked out by that. Like, how comfortable are they in themselves? Because, you know, some people do get really uptight about it. Some people are like, I can't cook and I don't care if people know that I can't cook. Yep. I mean, Joe Hockey is a great example. Yes. He's just like, you know, I can barbecue. And we get into the kitchen, he doesn't know where the knife drawer is in his own kitchen. Yeah. You know, and you think, well, that, you know, that's all. I don't know. It's interesting. It's people's sense of comfort within themselves, what they were worried about, what they get anxious about. I find all that stuff really interesting.
Well, look, I mean, we've put you through the ringer, so to speak. Obviously, we said you would be judging tarts.
Yeah.
There's no tarts. You've handled it very well. Congratulations.
Imagine the interview we would have got if we'd brought the tarts. Yeah. I mean, this was a good interview.
That's true. And yeah, people aren't watching us. People think there's going to be a tart interview now on the podcast. There's no tarts.
Has anyone ever got tarts?
No.
We've been tart-free.
No. John Howard got tarts, but he insisted on them.
Great.
It's part of his contract. Annabelle, it's always a joy. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about special delivery.
It's a pleasure, Bob. And you, Steve.
And remember, you can get spent home. If you like Annabelle, you can get special delivery from booktopia.com.au right now.
And I've just signed a million of them. So although my signature starts to look at like Anwar Sadat towards the end of a long pile of signings.
The people that get Alice Creasy's signature in the live
final. Also, I put a special message in one of them.
That's true. That's true. Tweet us at Booktopia or...
If you get the one with the special message in it, you'll know.
You'll know. And that's a Christmas gift. Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.